You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Will Dowd, whose debut essay collection is Areas of Fog, published by Etruscan Press. Will Dowd is a writer and artist from the Boston area. His writing and art have appeared in Lit Hub, Tin House Online, Post Road Magazine, The Rialto, NPR.org, and elsewhere. He has an MFA in creative writing from New York University, where he was a recipient of a Jacob K. Javits Fellowship. At MIT, where he earned his MS in science writing, he received the Lyons Fellowship, and his undergraduate work was done at Boston College. We discussed Areas of Fog, a collection of lyric essays touching on literature history and the vicissitudes of New England weather. When I spoke with him, I asked him to begin by talking about the bout of writer's block that impelled him to begin the project that led to this book. I will let him explain. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I was going through this bout of writer's block. Every strain of writer's block is a little bit different. And mine manifested as not an absence of creative energy, but just a lack of subject. Okay. I still woke up with all the fervor that you wake up with as a writer when you're raring to go, but I had no idea what to talk about. And this went on for quite a while until I hit upon what is essentially a sort of prompt motif, that I would write an essay every week and I would just talk about the weather, or at least start talking about the weather and maybe see where it went. And I got this idea because I'm from New England, I've grown up here, and we have a really annoying regional habit of just constantly talking about the weather, especially when we have nothing to talk about.
It's totally true.
Yes, we're all guilty of it. And you know, when I look back, I think, you know, sometimes a writer's block can come from a sense that you're missing a connection with your imagined reader. And so if we think about a reader not as, you know, some futuristic person who's going to reach up on a dusty library shelf in 100 years and take our book off the shelf, but instead as maybe someone we're going to sit next to on the bus, a stranger, and want to start a conversation with, then it makes sense to use our conversational tools, which is start with something neutral like the weather, which we all do, and just kind of get the conversation going. And so that's kind of the solution I hit upon. I did it for an entire year. I don't think I'll ever write about the weather again. I think I've exhausted that vein, but it worked. It worked for me in this case.
That's so much fun. The thing about how we always come, well, so you say that New Englanders always talk about the weather, but they also always complain about the weather. No matter what the weather is up here anyway, I feel like people are just always, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's been snowing too long, where's the snow? There's just always complaining.
Oh yeah, we're all Goldilocks around here. Absolutely.
You did sort of subtly cover that in one of your essays. You talked about sort of, oh good, it's summer, and then very quickly being like, oh, I can't wait until the October crisp leaves, crisp air and beautiful leaves.
Yeah, it's that thing. We always think the next season is going to solve everything, you know,
yeah.
But we bring our problems with us, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, it was really fun. Well, it was fun to read this anyway, but I started wondering what year this had been written, and then you gave us some, you'd eventually tell us, but early on I was trying to figure it out, and then you talk about Andrew Wyeth, and this is 5 years after his death, and so I looked it up, and I realized this was 2014.
Exactly, yep.
So in 2014, this is sort of a personal anecdote, but I'll just make it quick. In 2014,
yeah, sure.
My husband and I did this bike trip that we'd been planning for a really long time. We started in Key West, and we decided we were going to follow the spring north back to Vermont on our bikes.
Oh, how cool.
It was really cool, but it was the coldest and longest freaking, I mean, it was like we were hitting snow in Virginia. It was crazy. So reading about 2014 and the weather was very appropriate for me.
Yeah, the winter clung that year.
It really did.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember it was just a long and drawn out. And I remember thinking, I just can't wait for, I felt like I was in Groundhog's Day, especially at the beginning there. Every week just seemed to be, you know, a kind of repeat of slush and snow. And yeah, it lasted a while. It taxed my creative imagination for making it new and fresh.
You totally did. I really loved all the parts of this. It's not just weather. You talk about the stars and you talk about the moon and various moons, and you have reflections and personal anecdotes, and then you do a lot of observing and reflecting about historical figures, literary figures, and other figures like Joyce and Picasso and Emily Dickinson. And I loved your story about Eric Satie, who pushed his lover out a 3-story window. And
yes.
We're laughing, but she did live to tell the tale.
Yes, a happy ending there.
So how did the forms of these come to be? Did you just write and then you kind of figured out what it was going to be as you went?
Yeah, it was total improvisation.
Yeah.
And free association. I kind of, in the opening, in the introduction, which I wrote on like January 1st, I kind of talked about how I imagined every week creating this, you know, tiny literary snow globe where I would kind of put the weather in. And again, I was just thinking of a way to kind of free me up and take some of the burden or whatever was in my way, causing me writer's block away, and just create these small kind of weather globes. But what I ended up doing really is every week my head became the snow globe and I would sort of shake it up and see what kicked up. And oftentimes it was observations I had made throughout the week, what was going on in my life, but then also things that were preoccupying me, all my literary and historical obsessions, which I have quite a few. And so sort of inevitably, almost every week, some kind of historical figure would sort of waltz in through the side door. And I would weave them into this kind of small pattern that I was creating. So yeah, it's sort of a tour through my brain, really.
Which was really interesting to tour. Let me ask you, what is your educational background? Because it sounds like you've studied literature. Is that true? Or
yeah, absolutely. My educational background makes no sense in a linear way, but it always made sense to me. I was like a math and science kid. But then when I went to undergraduate, I was all in on the humanities. I did, you know, like a Western culture kind of Western civilization course, as well as English degree with some creative writing. And then promptly went off to MIT and did a science graduate degree.
Oh, wow.
And then after that, I did I went back to the creative writing at NYU, and I did an MFA there. So I sort of hopped around and... I remember getting some puzzled looks from my sort of teacher recommenders when I would ask for letters of recommendation to these various programs because they couldn't see the through line. But somehow, you know, I was just following my gut. I felt like I had a dowsing rod and I was just kind of going where it pointed. And these essays are a good representation of kind of where I've been. I really love the essay. You know, they're sort of tiny essays. They kind of verge on poetry a little bit. But what I liked about writing essays is they're really capacious. You can sort of put anything into them. You can bring in anything. And so I really felt like I was able to spread all my wings.
Yeah. Yeah. Now your background, it's interesting. That makes me think of Andrea Barrett, the author Andrea Barrett, who has a science background and became an absolutely beautiful, very literary writer. So I don't know. I think that mixture of background will serve you very well.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. There's always the danger that you're going to... I think it's every writer listening, and I'm sure you can relate, you never quite know if you're going to connect with your reader or if you're just too much of an oddball. I don't know, if you're like me, you're worried that you're just an outlier and you're not going to find your people or your readers. And I think we all worry about that. So it's nice to hear that at least one person feels like they connected to the work.
I definitely did. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how the work is structured. It made a lot of sense. It's chronological by month. You have three or four short essays in each month. But then I loved that your introduction is called the overture and your afterword is called the outro, and it made me think of music. Did you think of Weather as musical, or did you think of this collection as being sort of musical by the time you finished with it, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I did. You know, what it reminded me of was variations on a theme, and I think that's something that is music is able to capture so well. That's one field of which I am almost completely ignorant. Classical music, I just kind of listen in awe, but I don't know. I couldn't talk intelligently about it or what's happening to me as I listen or why. But I do recognize that kind of idea of a variation, and so that really appealed to me because every week was sort of. And it started in the same place. You know, it started with the weather every single week. It started the first paragraph, at least, was about the weather. So I thought that was a nice way to frame it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I loved the first sentence in the first essay, which is, "Nothing was happening this week weather-wise." That was a very funny way to begin.
Yeah, you know, I was banking when I started. You're banking on New England weather to deliver that. Right. Okay, do your thing. New England weather is very unique in that it feels like all climates of the world come to us. You know, like we're at the center of this carousel, and it just sort of they. You know, we get sort of every climate throughout the calendar year, and as a writer, you're just hoping for something different or new, something fresh, and. As that essay, you know, I talk about how the week, I remember that first essay, it was like nothing was happening. I'm like, oh no, what have I done? Committed to this project. But then midweek, I remember this fog rolled in and it was just so dramatic. Right. And so it was beautiful. It really solidified that this there would be something to write about every week, rain or shine.
Yeah. And you have some beautiful observations about fog. I loved that you said that fog, Victorian authors used fog to drop a veil on their hyper-rational industrialized metropolis. That's so true. and then also, I loved this. Do you mind if I just read a quick bit?
No, please.
Fog belongs on the first page of novels. That's how literature comes to us. It emerges from the ghostly haze of the blank page. And if you take just a few steps into it, you lose sight of who you were and where you came from. And that's such a perfect analogy to how it feels when you start writing something. And then, of course, that must have led to your title, Areas of Fog.
Yes.
I'm guessing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, believe it or not, I had the title before that first essay, which it seems predetermined in this reverse causality way. But I picked Areas of Fog as the title because I had no idea what the entries were going to look like. And so I wanted a kind of label that would be a little bit vague and ambiguous and could just kind of cover everything, whatever I was going to put inside it. And Areas of Fog felt like it accomplished that. But then indeed the fog did come that first week. And through the whole year, that was one of the central questions sort of lurking in the back of this collection is this idea of fate and whether things are predetermined or accidental. And so there were a lot of almost spooky coincidences and things that sort of came back and boomeranged thematically. And so that was one of them. It looks in retrospect like I was very intelligently planning ahead, but again, it seemed like an invisible hand kind of gave me that nice opening.
Yeah.
But I do believe, you know, it's not just as a writer when you go into one of these projects that you're kind of entering this fog and you're, but also as a reader. That's how I feel when you start reading a book. You sort of go in, you're almost newborn into the story, and. It's the pleasure of getting lost in a book and kind of going in and losing your identity a little bit or who in emerging as someone different than who you were. I think that's one of the great things about reading.
Yeah.
And it's also a little bit dangerous, you know, because right. you're never quite the same person when you finish a book.
Yeah, and it's true too that when you go in, there's the fog of just not knowing what is the world that you've just entered. And sometimes that can be a little bit frustrating. And I think that the harder it is to get in, and if you if you happen to make it through, the more satisfying it is at the end. Is that
right? Absolutely.
Yeah. So now I'm curious if you've ever, let me just preface that by saying you have some wonderful observations early on about whether men, and the madness of trying to predict the weather in New England is very funny.
Yes.
But I just wondered if you'd ever heard the Vermont Eye on the Sky forecast. Have you ever spent any time in Vermont?
Only just briefly, just passing through in some hiking trips. But no, I haven't heard the Eye in the Sky. Can you fill me in? Yeah.
So our sort of most, I think, to me, well-known weather forecasts on the radio are aired on Vermont Public Radio. And they have these Vermont Eye on the Sky guys, and they are famous for these huge forecasts that I actually looked on the website this morning. It's only a little over 2 minutes, but it feels like such a long forecast, and you sit there and it's like this famous joke. It's ongoing. Everybody loves the Eye on the Sky, but they can't remember what the weather is by the time these guys finish. Because there's like all this analysis, all this stuff about what's going on. And by the end, you're like, wait, what's it going to do today?
Yeah, so is it going to rain or not? I've experienced a similar thing down here in the Boston area. The weather has become such a sort of regional sport almost that the weathermen will stand in front of that map and get so technical about sort of why things are happening that you just sort of, you're kind of waiting for the end when they just flash the week with the picture, you know, of like a sun or a rain. You're like, can we just get to that? Because that's what I need to know in terms of whether I need an umbrella. So that, I've never heard the Eye in the Sky, but I do think it's a New England thing.
Yeah,
Spent time down in Florida, and it's very different because they don't really have, you know, it's a shorter set when you're a meteorologist down there. It's a little bit quicker.
I just have one last observation about, you know, starting with weather. The cliche phrase, it was a dark and stormy night, comes to mind. And I'm like, maybe that was just somebody's way in, and then they forgot to get rid of it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I remember this is something that you'll hear a lot if you take a poetry workshop and probably a fiction workshop. I'm just more familiar with the poetry ones,
right?
Which is a teacher or maybe a fellow student in the class might say to you, you know, I really like the first stanza, but that's your runway stanza. You know, you really take off in the second stanza. So just chop that first one out. And it's true that sometimes we do a lot of throat clearing, and the weather can be part of that. And there's a lot of writers who use the weather for that reason. I kind of in these essays lean into it and see if I can really use the weather in a different way. And I talk about at the beginning the weather never getting its literary due. It's you know, it's just kind of this. I think they say it's like writers only ever use the atmosphere for atmosphere. And so I was kind of seeing if you could explore weather in a different way. So it's not just neutral filler. But what is it really doing to us? And one of the things I came upon is the weather is really a communal experience. It's one of the few communal experiences we have left. I mean, everybody walks around now isolated in their iPods, you know, living kind of in their own TV shows that are on separate channels. And I feel like we don't connect. It's harder to connect nowadays. But if it's, you know, snowing horizontally into people's faces as they're all waiting at the bus stop, you're all connected by that. And
I think
that was something I discovered as I wrote it, was how communal it is.
Yeah. That reminds me of another quote in the book that's about the burden of being the New Englander. I loved this. The quote is, why is winter happening to me?
Right. Yeah, we all take the weather personally, don't we?
We do. But I also think in New England, we also, not all, but I think a lot of New Englanders really love the winter, too.
I agree. I mean, there's a lot of, many of the people I know who really hate the weather eventually get out. You know, hate the winter. You've got to come to terms with it in some way. You've got to find the beauty in it. You know, Mark Twain talked about the kind of perversity of New England weather and how much he hated it until after an ice storm, you see a tree clothed from, you know, roots to tip in ice and lit up by a setting sun and sort of bejeweled and dazzling. And then he says, okay, New England weather, we're square, we're even, because that's so beautiful.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's see. I want to talk about one of your essays is called The Live Long June.
Yes.
And this was funny to me. You start out by writing about spending an entire morning attempting to balance an egg on your kitchen floor, only later remembering that that's for the equinox and not summer solstice. And then you write, I resolved not to tell anyone. And I loved this because clearly you're sharing it with everyone who's going to read your book.
That's right.
And this is what writers do. We have to tell. We have to tell. We can't not tell.
Yes.
So I thought we could talk a minute about how much we have to tell. We're very...
I don't know if we're exhibitionists.
Exhibitionists. Thank you. That's maybe, what I was looking
but,
for.
But to me, there's an intimacy to that, right? Because it's an embarrassment. I mean, it was a stupid thing I did. It was very foolish. And yet, it's almost, you know, it's funny. It depends on how you see your particular reader and what you're trying to do with writing. To me, I'm trying to have a new best friend, you know, and that's how I see the reader, as this kind of intimate companion who I can tell a stupid, foolish thing I've done, and they're gonna laugh with me and not at me.
Oh, absolutely.
And I could be wrong, but that's my ideal reader, and that's what I had in my head. And I should say, you know, when I was writing this, I'm a new writer. This became my first published book. So, you know, when I was writing to the reader in a very direct way, it was aspirational. I was sort of trying to conjure a reader into being, and so. This felt like part of it was like telling my observations and my secrets to someone who didn't quite exist, but maybe someday would.
Right. Okay. Let's see. I wanted to ask you, this is actually not about your book, but I did a little reading on the internet and I found your Poets and Writers writer recommends thing that you did, and you recommend tarot cards as a way in. I wondered if you can talk a little bit about using tarot cards to find your way into your writing.
Yeah, I was asked sort of, how do you keep your creative flow going? And I said that whenever I hit a literary crossroads where there's a sort of fork in the road, yeah, I do turn to the tarot cards. And, in my sort of regular life, I'm this materialist, scientific materialist. I'm a skeptic. I actually have written some articles for Skeptic magazine, but in my writing life, I'm just a complete mystic, and I totally believe in that there are, you know, things on the other side of the tapestry kind of at work, whether that's the unconscious mind or something else, I don't know, but I trust in it. And so, yeah, I will go to the tarot cards, and the reason why I think they work, if you kind of ask them a question, is because, you know, I use the, you know, mostly use what's called the major arcana, which is these kind of ancient symbols, or at least medieval, and you interpret the symbols. So, you know, you could ask a question and get a kind of series, and then you make up you're ultimately making up your decision about what they mean and where they're pointing you. And so really you're kind of communing with yourself. It goes to my belief, which is that when you're truly stuck and you don't know which way to go and you don't know what to write about, whether this project or that project, or do I still continue with this thing that seems to be stalled, I think in your gut you really know,
right?
But somehow you need to bring that to the surface, and bringing in something that's a little bit, that an image that you can interpret in different ways allows that to kind of bubble up and come to conscious awareness.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. And yeah. Well, we're talking about trying to figure out what you're going to write. You have a great thing in your essay in February, An Inner Scheme. This was really fun. You write a great deal on the first page of this essay about what your plan had been, and you write in great detail about what you were going to write. I'm not looking at it, but I should be, because I want to just give a couple examples of what you say.
Sure.
Here we go. Let's see. So I planned to write about prognostication, a theme suggested, no surprise here, by the punctual reemergence of Punxsutawney Phil. Okay. And then you go on. And then I was going to address the lead up to Wednesday's early morning snow bestowal. And then you go on. And then I thought I would discuss the animal tracks I saw Tuesday night, a groundhog's. And you go on and on. And then you say, but I don't want to write about all that. It seems too predictable somehow, too predetermined.
Right.
That was so much fun. But it also made me think about writers who plan their work ahead of time versus let things kind of happen organically. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about your approach to that.
Yeah. Robert Frost said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Right.
And yeah. I totally buy that. I totally believe in that. I think there can be something really stale if everything is mapped out ahead of time. And it's just sort of a game you're playing, almost you know, if you're reverse engineering something. I feel like the reader can tell, unless you really cover your tracks well. But for me, this was, again, these were kind of written as in a very playful spirit, as these kind of, again, this kind of weather prompt. And so it didn't, you know, I wasn't trying to hit a mark at the end. I wasn't trying to prove anything. In particular, I was trying to have an experience, and so that lent itself to sort of improvisation and free association and letting go of the net, you know, and just seeing what else might come. And inevitably, it was more interesting to me and hopefully for the reader when I, all you know, the things I've been thinking about during the week, I let those kind of go away, and I just took a leap of faith that whatever I could write about, whatever was in front of me. In this case, I think the icicles in my window as I was sitting at my desk caught my attention, and I just went with the icicles. And I didn't know if that could become interesting, but I think it did ultimately. So,
yeah. And I thought that was a really nice essay to kind of explain sort of experientially the pros and cons of planning ahead versus letting something just happen.
Right.
Now, I do, that leads me to another question I have, which is, I'll go back to my anecdote about the bike trip. When we were on our bike trip, we blogged about it. So, but, you know, having the subject matter of this bike trip meant that we were naturally noticing things we might not have otherwise noticed. And during the day, as we're riding, we're thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to write about that later. And that was really fun. And it kind of created all this stuff. On the other hand, once you start a project, there is this... there is this mandate to write for the project. And so I think sometimes my work was less organic. And sometimes it did feel like I was forcing something out because I had started a blog. So was there any of that ever around these essays? And if so, did those not make it into the collection? That's kind of a long question, but...
No, I totally agree. Once you've committed, then what could start off as a whimsical adventure could become plotting work, and absolutely, that's a danger. And so I had this wonderful remedy called procrastination. So I just wouldn't do it until the very last minute, when I absolutely had to do it. And I'm definitely kind of an adrenaline writer, and so I would go right up to the deadline, was staring me in the face, and then I would sit down and do it. So it didn't, you know, it definitely, there were times when it felt like, okay, I'd rather not be sitting here writing this. I'd rather be doing something else. But that only lasted for a brief time because I pushed it till the very edge. It depends on your schedule. I mean, it was pretty much Sunday mornings I would do them. So it wasn't, you know, I wasn't spending all week writhing around in agony that I had to write this weather thing.
Were you taking notes sometimes during the week and thinking, oh, there's something that I can...
Yeah. Every once in a while I would put something down. I don't think they very often made it in at all.
Oh.
Yeah. Because, you know, again, it's like they would sort of just be something, some random metaphor might occur. But once you're actually sitting Once I was sitting and I decided what I was going to write about, what aspect of the weather, and was sort of just started to roll, it didn't really behoove the essay to bring in a kind of a random burr that had, you know, I'd picked up on my pant leg throughout the week. But so I don't know. So there's probably a thing in my iPhone, a notes, you know, some repository of just weather based observations that never made it in. Maybe I'll do like a B-side version. You know, it's funny. Mark Twain, to go back to him, he wrote this book called The American Claimant. And he said, you know, weather just is this gets in the way of the narrative of all these books. So he says, so I just wrote an appendix filled with weather, and the reader can just at their leisure turn to the back and read it whenever they feel the need. I think I've probably got something like that on my iPhone.
That's great. Let's see. Will, I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading from Areas of Fog. I was thinking you could read the essay Carry On.
Sure. Absolutely. This is from February.
Okay, great.
Carry On. According to the news, it's a war out there. This week, a blizzard dragged its icy talons up the East Coast, severing power lines and snapping utility poles. Winter Storm Pax, apparently named by a sardonic Latin scholar working at the Weather Channel, laid siege to Atlanta and entombed Charleston. The news made it sound like North Carolina died. When the storm finally reached Massachusetts on Thursday, it just stood there and delivered a long, commanding lecture on the nature of slush. In Boston, an entire street was shut down when a 6-foot icicle fell 3 stories and almost harpooned a pedestrian. It's possible that, for once, the weathermen aren't exaggerating. It is a war out there. Speaking of which, I've always thought a decent dissertation could be written on the so-called Southie Parking Wars. There's a tradition in South Boston. If you dig out a public parking space after a major snowstorm, you temporarily own it, so long as you mark your territory by leaving some sort of object in the excavated space. Whenever a territorial claim is violated, tires get slashed, windows get smashed, and sometimes heads get bashed. It's been called a gentleman's agreement, and given the mayor's tacit consent, the whole thing has a vague semi-legal status. More than anything, I'm interested in what people choose to leave in their shoveled-out spaces. While it's often cones, which have an air of officialdom, you also see a lot of beach chairs, open and turned toward the street. These chairs work because they play a mind game. You can't help but imagine the owner sitting there like a ghost, watching intently, a tire iron resting across his knees. In fact, it's all mind games. You often see children's bicycles, which are good for sympathy. I once saw an old toilet. Who's going to touch that? And then there's the really small, frail gestures. Ironing boards, empty shopping bags, gloves, which work by reverse psychology. Whoever has the audacity to leave an old shoe must be a trained killer. The ultimate power play, I've always thought, would be to shovel out your space and then erect a small house of cards. Like I said, it's a war out there, and there's more to come. Tonight, my swath of Massachusetts is forecast to receive another bombardment of 8 to 10 inches. Already, tiny flakes are arriving like light infantry. The weathermen are beginning to sound like Winston Churchill, whose wartime speeches gave comfort to the Britons huddled around their wireless sets as bombs fell from the sky. Churchill used to spend 8 hours at a stretch working on his broadcasts, and his best lines still echo today on coffee mugs and specialty greeting cards. A new book, however, suggests that the public wasn't as inspired by Churchill's speeches as we imagine in retrospect. They didn't like his long-windedness. They couldn't bear his fondness for double negatives. And there was a widespread suspicion that during his speeches, he wasn't not drunk. I'd like to do something, or at least say something, to help you all get through this winter, this war. I think I'll leave you with these words. Keep calm and, well, you know the rest.
Thank you very much for reading that. That's Will Dowd reading from Areas of Fog, published by Etruscan Press. So thank you.
Yes, you're very welcome.
Well, one thing that you talk about in the collection is the language of weather. And that was great because, as you mentioned at the early part of that piece, the Weather Channel has started naming smaller storms in addition to the hurricanes and tsunamis and everything else now.
Yes.
And then you also address words that we lack, which I really enjoyed, and how the Japanese have words for some of the weather events that we don't have. So sort of like, I think one that you said was we should have a word for that first windshield swipe of snow.
Yeah, that sound that when you first go out to your car in the morning and it snowed and frosted overnight and you turn the windshields on and it makes that horrible freaking noise that just it goes deep into your soul and you're shivering and behind your wheel.
Those are the mornings that you're lucky enough to get in the car because the lock wasn't frozen.
Yeah, exactly. You've already wrestled with the handle, thinking maybe you're going to snap it off because it won't open.
Exactly.
Yes.
So those were all really fun. And then you have haiku about weather. I guess that, you know, some of the Japanese poets are very weather oriented. I know that's true.
And yes.
Those were really fun. And then you have another. So I said earlier about your winter, why is winter happening to me? Then you have a wonderful quote about spring. Or I'm going to quote you. You write in the book, spring doesn't care about us.
Right.
That was fun too.
Yeah, I was talking. I remember that particular year that I wrote this, there seemed to be all these things lining up. It was sort of the beginning of spring. I think it was Easter. You know, there was kind of all this calendrical things happening at once. And so there was a sense that I don't know, somehow the season was kind of in our control or on our side. And so I had a quick note to remind that nature is not here for us. It's kind of doing its own thing. And we're always waiting for spring like this savior after winter. But man, does spring take a while to actually arrive. It kind of fakes you out. Like, I'm thinking of like a basketball player thinking they're going to go left and then you go right. And you kind of stumble on defense. It sort of seems to arrive and then winter comes back with a fury. And so I think it's always premature and you have to be wary about getting too excited about the spring as it has come. You need to protect your hope there because it can be defeating.
And we sort of don't even have it in Vermont. We just have mud season
and then summer.
That's it.
Right.
So one thing that I noticed as I was reading, Will, is that most of these reflections are very solitary. You don't tend to include scenes where you are with other people. And I just wondered if that was a purposeful plan, that these essays would mostly just be your own reflections on weather. Did you include some scenes and then decide, that's not really working with the whole? How did that happen?
I mean, to be honest, part of it was just a natural outgrowth of being solitary. I had been off. I gave you my kind of CV earlier, and
right.
So I've been off for almost a decade, studying and being surrounded by classmates. And then I moved back to my hometown, and I don't know. I think a lot of people can kind of relate when you've left for a long time and then you come back to your hometown and you're a different person. The town hasn't changed and you sort of feel like an alien in your own, the place where you came from. And so, I was pretty, pretty lonely and isolated, that year. And so it was just kind of me and the falling leaves and this reader that I was, hoping to have. I'm pretty interested in the old magic of a person who's alone writing and being read by somebody else who's alone. I'm not too taken by this social media thing. I think it's the technology has kind of crowded out our alone time, our time for reflection and meditation. But it's also drowned out that communication between two lonely people. You know, one writes something down, puts it in a bottle, throws it in the waves, and the other one receives it and takes it out and reads it. I think there's something really special about that, and it's a bit on the wane at the moment, but I still believe in it. And I think it can be a stronger and more intimate communication, albeit at a distance. So yeah, it was part of my part of my passion with this project.
Yeah. Okay. That's really, I love that analogy to social media and what we've lost by not having our solitude or not encouraging it like we once did.
Right.
Okay. Now, you have a wonderful essay in here. It jumped in the middle in July and kind of slapped the reader around a little bit. And it's called Ocean Sounds. And it's, I think the reason I reacted this way, it's Ocean Sounds and then Overheard at Nantasket Beach. And it's wonderful because it's just a completely different form than the rest of the essays take. You offer random snippets of dialogue, which you overheard at the beach. And then you, you add some editorial notes as to how you interpreted these things and what they made you think about. And it was so much fun. And it also just broke up the essays in an interesting way. And it made me think about the fact that essays are sort of like poems in that they can sort of allow for more formal experimentation around form.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas fiction, I mean, I suppose some fiction collections will do a bit of that, but not mainstream fiction for the most part. So I wonder if you can just talk about the freedom to write essays as you want to.
Yeah, it's true because, you know, I think fiction has to always have its eye on this thing called drama, you know, in storytelling. And those are, I mean, incredibly difficult and have their own burdens. The essay, or at least the kind of essay I was writing in this, the whole idea behind this project was kind of setting myself free from maybe some constraining ideas I picked up in all that schooling. I just gave myself permission, and the essay as a form doesn't necessarily need to have, you know, I wasn't writing argumentative essays, and I didn't have a kind of narrative to serve, so I didn't need to be moving characters around. My intention was solely to almost let the reader into what was going on in my brain or my life, and hopefully create an experience for them. And so this, to me, which was essentially just writing down things I was overhearing at the beach with a little bit of, as you said, editorial comment, that was bringing the reader, having them sit on my beach towel with me and, you know, use my ears. And then I'm also kind of making side comments to them about what that might have meant, that thing I just overheard. And so it just felt like a way to, again, bring the reader into my life, into my space, into my mind. And I love that the essay allows you to do that.
Yeah. And one thing about it that I really loved was, you know, you are sort of pointing the camera at all these different people or pointing the microphone at all these different people. And then in the very end, somebody looks at you and says to their friend, who's this guy? What's he writing? And that it was like this great way out. It's like, oh, now he's looking at me.
It is true. You can, you know, it was a lot of fun to do, but you think, sometimes as a writer, I don't know. I think all writers are starers, right? We're set at restaurants and we listen, we eavesdrop and we stare at people. That's just kind of in our nature.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we get caught and all of a sudden you feel awkward and self-conscious where before you'd just been totally absorbed. I think of Emerson talking about, you know, he had this great slightly cartoonish image of himself as just an eyeball with legs walking through nature. And someone did a great famous cartoon of it from the 1800s. And I just love that. I mean, it's kind of like a wacky Far Side cartoon, but it's how we feel sometimes as writers. You're just trying to be super sensitive, opening up your ears, opening up your eyes, taking it all in. And you sort of need to be, once you become self-conscious, then yeah, it's, you gotta, you wrap it up.
Yeah. let's see. I wonder if I can ask you to read another section. You have an essay called The Painter of Sunflowers, which also takes place in July.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. Happy to read it.
Okay, great.
This is called The Painter of Sunflowers. Between the crushing heat of the July sun in the occasional flash flood, it's been a difficult week for people and flowers. We're all feeling a bit withered. Only my neighbor's sunflowers, which bloomed over the weekend, seemed to be thriving. When I spotted these sunflowers, I thought of Vincent van Gogh, who had already been on my mind. He worshipped sunflowers and painted them compulsively, from life in summer, from memory in winter. A portrait by Paul Gauguin, his friend and rival, shows him in the act. It's called The Painter of Sunflowers. Van Gogh hated it. "It's certainly me, but it's me gone mad," he said. I like the painting's forced perspective, how it looks as if Van Gogh is painting the sunflower itself into existence. When it comes to Van Gogh in his short life, reality and metaphor are swirled together. This was, after all, a man who nibbled his oil paints like an aspiring synesthete. It began early, when his mother delivered a stillborn son named Vincent van Gogh. Our Van Gogh, the replacement child, was born a year later to the day. He was both Vincent and a metaphor for the lost Vincent. Later, as a painter of blazing pastures in the south of France, he suffered bouts of mania and delirium. Did he stare too long into the sun of his creative passion, or was it just severe sunstroke? I think Van Gogh's suicide was a metaphor too, or at least it was meant to be. Just a few weeks before he shot himself in a wheat field, he'd borrowed a revolver to scare off crows. His brother Theo announced he was moving to Holland. Theo was the wooden frame to Vincent's stretched canvas. Without Theo, Vincent's financial and emotional survival was at risk. In the past, whenever someone tried to leave, Van Gogh resorted to self-mutilation. When Gauguin moved out of the Yellow House, he sliced off his left ear with a razor. When a girl he loved skipped town, he held his hand over a candle flame, vowing to keep it there until she returned. When Van Gogh shot himself in the chest, he missed his heart. It was supposed to be a symbolic act, a metaphor. "This is what you are doing to me, Theo." And it only became literal as the result of an inept country doctor. At least that's how I read it. And this brings me to the reason why Van Gogh has been on my mind. An Italian artist named Demut Streb has unveiled a living replica of Van Gogh's left ear, the one he severed, which she recreated using DNA from an envelope Van Gogh sealed in 1883. The ear was grown in Boston with the help of scientists from MIT and Harvard. It's currently on display in a German museum. Until now, if you hope to divine the true source of Van Gogh's madness and solve the mystery of his suicide, you had to study the letters and stare at the paintings. How much easier it will be to pluck a red hair from a thick brushstroke and grow another Van Gogh and watch to see how this one kills himself. Van Gogh was buried in a hilltop cemetery. His coffin was heaped with sunflowers. It was late July. According to one mourner, the sun was unbearable.
Thank you so much. Sure. I loved that one. There's just so much happening in that essay, and I thought that was such a really perfect little gem.
Thank you very much.
Now, I don't understand how you can grow just an ear and the left one. How did she do that?
I don't know. I mean, so from what I can tell, she's a conceptual artist it wouldn't never have occurred to me to grow Van Gogh's ear. and then even if it had, I'm too conservative in some way to have done it. I would have thought that would have just crossed some kind of ethical boundaries, but it didn't for this artist. And then the artist was able to make use of these scientists in Boston at these universities to help her make it a reality. And it's such a strange convergence of science and art and history and the grotesque, in my opinion.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. It's like the, I'm not going to remember the name of the show. Remember the art show that that traveled several years ago, and it was anatomical, the corpses do you know what I'm talking about?
It was showing cross, like almost cross sections of the human body.
Yeah.
Yeah. And showing like the Yeah, and I remember that there was controversy around that show because it was about where the corpses had come from. And
right.
Yeah, it does that. I remember I went to that actually, and I remember it being horrifying and fascinating, and then it left you with all kinds of ethical questions.
Very. Will, I wanted to ask, what are you reading these days that you might recommend to people who are listening?
Sure. So I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and I really love when authors read their audiobooks. Not every author is a great reader of their own work, but when they are, it's really special. And you sort of transforms the work in your mind. And so here's a few recommendations.
Yeah.
Ali Smith, an author from England, yeah. She wrote this book called Artful, and she does the audiobook, and she has this incredible, fast-paced, really deft voice, and it moves through this very free associative lectures, which she had given on art and imagination, and that's just a beautiful audiobook. Another one I could recommend is Kevin Barry, an Irish writer who wrote this novel called City of Bohan, which is sort of like that show Deadwood, but as if it had been written by James Joyce. It's this incredible Irish take on a kind of dystopian town. And that's beautiful. And then the last one I wanted to mention was this young writer, Scott McClanahan, who wrote The Sarah Book, which is a really devastating novel about the breakup of a marriage. And I listened to it this summer. I was actually in the hospital quite a bit this summer with I had got meningitis, and I listened to this book at night in the hospitals, and it was so bleak, and yet it took me out of my setting and absorbed me and kind of took me out of my own predicament, which again is something reading can do. And when you combine it with the voice of a great audiobook and the author reading, it really feels intimate. So those are three good ones.
Okay, great. And that your second one reminds me of one that I just listened to, because I also love listening to audiobooks. And it's really popular right now. It's called The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne. And it's also an Irish, it's not read by the author, but it's really, I loved listening to that one.
Well, I'll have to put that on my list.
Put it
I'm
on
always
your list.
Look out for a good one, yeah.
And it's funny and serious at the same time. So,
that's great.
What are you writing these days?
Oh, I'm working on a couple different projects. So I've been working on a kind of steadily, slowly working on this project that is a sort of combining art and writing.
Uh-huh.
So it's sort of like word art, and it's biographical in nature. So it's again using some of these historical figures, which are feel really present to me, and I feel very connected to, and taking a kind of slice from their life, and then using an interesting layout and a kind of graphic design. It's again, I don't have an elevator pitch for it. It's very unique and difficult to describe, which is not good if you're trying to sell something. But it's kind of what I've been up to, and I'm hoping that when it's finished, people will enjoy those.
Yeah.
So that's probably the next thing I'll be able to finish, and I've got a lot of other irons in the fire, which I love far away projects. They always feel the best because they're still perfect, right? they haven't hit reality yet.
Woody Allen had a great quote about that. I know we're not really supposed to quote Woody Allen anymore, but I still do.
Right.
He sort of said that the best movies he'd ever made had never gotten made yet, or they were still in his head, or I can't remember the exact wording, but
right, they're still perfect.
Yeah, that same. So let's see. I just have one last question for you, Will, and that is, I know that this project was born of a period of writer's block that you had, and you have this great line in the book. You said, "Have you ever known a diarist to suffer writer's block?"
Right.
And that was great. So I wonder if you can offer a little advice for listeners who might be writers suffering from writer's block.
Absolutely. One thing I would recommend if I could travel back in time would be to really think about and play around with your relationship with your reader, because sometimes it can be paralyzing trying to write for the whole world or trying to write to please so many different voices in your head. But maybe lower the stakes and think about writing a letter to a friend, or sort of just get some of that burden of writing for maybe posterity off your shoulders. And whether it's a journal or a letter, I would say try to write in a more direct way to a single person. And maybe that can kind of break the ice that's formed around your writing life. And then the other last thing I would say about it is, it's not something, your writing voice is not something you can necessarily reverse engineer. It's not like you stack a bunch of books that you admire on a table and think, okay, I'd like to be the combination of all of these. I think you are who you are, and your voice is what it is. And you don't necessarily choose the kind of writer you are. You sort of accept the kind of writer that you are. And so sometimes if I'm blocked, it's because I'm trying to be somebody else. And so coming back in a kind way and accepting kind of who you are and what's great about that can be helpful psychologically.
That's fantastic advice. That's great. Thank you very much. So I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Areas of Fog by Will Dowd, and it's published by Etruscan Press. Will, thank you very much for speaking with me. This is a lovely collection of essays. It was a real pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Shayla. I'm a real fan of your show.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Will Dowd. We discussed his book Areas of Fog, published by Etruscan Press. Then you can learn more about his work at willdowd.net. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Will Dowd, who suggests that you begin writing about the weather. Let your mind free associate and see where the winds take you. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, please let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as always, if you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. We haven't had a lot of comments lately on iTunes, so if you know how to access that information and go and add a comment, that would be awesome. We would love that. Thank you so much. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. We are streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.